Care Committee to order, and today we have a variety of things. We're going to start off with a work session on Senate Bill 59A. Sandy, do you want to let us know what this is? And I think Representative Cannon was carrying this from the Access Subcommittee. So I'm just, you're up. Pay attention. You're on deck there.
Thank you for the morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 59A comes to you from the Senate floor with 26 ayes, 3 noes, and 1 excuse. This bill reenacts a requirement that was repealed under the automatic repeal provisions pertaining to the mandated health insurance coverage that a health insurance policy provide coverage for acupuncture services performed by a physician and to provide coverage for acupuncture services performed by a licensed acupuncturist. It was an unintended consequences of a deletion of a repeal provision, and they are asking to have that reinserted, I believe.
Thank you, Sandy. That sounds super technical. Representative Cannon,
Madam Chair, I will do my best. I understand this is a very technical bill that exempts, the most important part of this is that it exempts the requirement that this statute is automatically repealed. So somehow it became subject to an automatic repeal provision. And the point of this bill is to make it no longer subject to an automatic repeal provision. And if that repeal, it would repeal the mandate on coverage, is that right?
For acupuncture,
yes,
services.
Right.
So that's the bill.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's one of the more circuitous things that we deal with here. I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 59A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Gell. So the motion on the table is to move Senate Bill 59A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion or questions? Representative Ford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just looking to see where the repeal and reinstatement language was repealed and reinserted. So I think, is that on page 2?
No.
Mr. Kafouri for the acupuncturist are here. If you want.
The repeal is in section 3.
Page 1,
section 3 is the
repeal of the statute. Okay.
That and at the very last page, there's a section 10 has.
If my understanding is correct, members of the committee, the language that got repealed under the automatic repeal, we had to add it back in. That's the new language of Section 1, 2, and Section 10. Then we identify in Section 3.
The actual repeal statute?
Right. So we had to reinsert. Is that accurate?
I believe that is the case, Sandy. And then the exemption is on page 2. Line 15 and 16, is that your understanding as well? That this section,
right,
that section 4, 743.700, is the automatic repeal.
Mm-hmm.
And the very last line of that section says that automatic repeal does not apply to acupuncture services.
Gotcha.
This was a complex thing to sort through.
Good memory, Representative. Very technical. Any other questions about the bill? Seeing none, Aaron, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
And with that, we will move it to the floor. And
Barry?
Yes.
Could I possibly move this bill to the consent calendar?
Fantastic idea. There's a motion to move it to the consent calendar. Any objections? Seeing none, so moved, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 59A. We're going to go right to the next one, which is Senate Bill 491. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 491A. Sandy? And Ron? Oh, Representative Maurer, you're... Okay.
Do you want to go?
Go ahead, Sandy.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 491A also comes from the Senate side. It has no revenue, but it does have a fiscal impact that should be a part of your meeting materials, and it's more of a fiscal statement rather than an impact. It just gives explanation on OMIP and DCBS's role in the cochlear implants under certain circumstances, but this bill requires health insurers that provide coverage for cochlear implant to provide coverage of bilateral cochlear implants. It provides it for purposes of unfair claim settlement practices. Reasonable investigation of a claim for a bilateral cochlear implant must include a recommendation from the treating surgeon based on medical literature and finding, and this also exempts the provisions from the automatic repeal. It left the Senate floor with 24 ayes, 2 noes, 1 absent, and 3 excused.
Thank you, Sandy. Representative Maurer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill obviously is paying for 2 cochlear implants rather than 1, or would require that. And the question is, what is the benefit to having 2 cochlear implants versus 1? And I think the focus of the conversation was primarily around children, and that the first off, the number of these procedures done in the state is very limited, and that clearly the cost is twice as much. The cost for 2 versus 1 is $109,000 to $54,000. So there's an upfront financial cost, but the benefit to the children for this procedure, I think, far outweighs any cost to the state. And the example is, or was that was given, is the children's ability to adapt linguistically and adapt socially was tremendous. That I don't know, it would be a magnitude, what kind of magnitude, but it was substantial. And for us that hear out of both ears, we hear in stereo, but when you hear in a monotone, it is clearly something that is will inhibit your development. If you put one hand over an eye, and put one hand over one eye, you have your inability to perceive spatial differences, distances is very limited. And imagine that with sound. And so the testimony that was presented was, I think, pretty overwhelmingly supportive of the procedure, and the insurance companies that testified were in support of it. And this is an issue where the statute is behind the medicine. And so it came out of subcommittee with unanimous support.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cannon, did you want to add something?
I was going to add something, but Representative Maurer got to it. Just to underscore the fact that the insurance companies did not oppose this, do not oppose this, and that the evidence that it provides long-term financial benefits for the family and the company are extensive, and it's a good bill.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for people on the Access Subcommittee who may know the answer. Might there be a situation where somebody only needs one cochlear implant? For example, if they have one working ear, and then because the statute says that whenever they're entitled to reimbursement of a cochlear implant, they're entitled to coverage of bilateral. But do they all need bilateral?
The answer is there has to be medical evidence to support that you need both of the implants. But we have an expert here that will be able to answer that question for us.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Deckert's office. Vice Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici, as Representative Marr said, the medical, the doctor who is working on the case would be one of the voices in that decision. There are absolutely situations in which one cochlear implant is necessary. This is addressing situations where 2 implants are necessary, and in the past the insurance company has paid for only one, citing the fact that the second was experimental or unnecessary for not medically necessary, whereas I think a lot of people feel it's a quality of life issue for especially for children who have the need for both. And there's been a lot of explanation of the reasoning behind that.
Thank you. And we have some written testimony prepared from the Senator's office. Thank you for providing that.
Yes.
And just to clarify, this is if they're covering the implants now, it just says if it makes sense to have two, cover two.
Yes, Vice Chair Krotek, yes, that's absolutely right. In situations where it would be necessary, this is already being covered by the insurance company. Now they would be covering both as opposed to just one. And, that's it.
Thank you. Yes. Other questions, comments? Representative Richardson.
The information says that there's 100,000 of these worldwide, and in there the next sentence goes into talking about children, but there's no indication as to whether a large number are children, or children are the exception. Or, I mean, I don't know if seniors have a huge number of these. Is there any breakdown into who receives these the two operations?
Representative, you're referring to the summary there in the...
Yes.
Okay. Representative?
Okay. In the fiscal analysis, I don't know if you have this midway, two-thirds of the way down, Oregon OMIP under the Department of Consumer and Business Services currently covers FDA-approved unilateral cochlear implants in certain circumstances. Historical statistics suggest that only about two unilateral implants are performed per biennium.
That's maybe because only one gets covered.
Well, they're saying they cover a unilateral cochlear implant. They don't cover bilateral.
Okay, gotcha.
And Madam Chair, if I could follow up, my recollection, and perhaps Sasha could confirm this, is that these bilateral implants are generally most effective when performed on children. So we're actually the likely universe of recipients for these, given the state of the medical literature now, as much for bilateral is perhaps smaller than the possible universe of people who are qualified for the unilateral implant.
Can I respond? Vice Chair Krotek, Representative Cannon. Actually, a lot of the folks who have these implants are children. There are certain specific situations in which an adult will have profound hearing loss, in which they would respond very positively to a bilateral cochlear implant. And, in fact, their response time to the implants is actually quicker than a child because they're not learning for the first time how sound works. They are relearning, and it's a very different type of sound. We've understood from the audiologists that have explained this to us, but it is much smaller. I believe it's a much smaller number, but there certainly are instances in which this is, and that's why we actually discussed putting an age limit on that, and that's why we chose not to, because there are certain instances in which this would be effective for adults.
Thank you.
Yes.
Other questions, comments?
One further comment. They gave an example of an adult, Rush Limbaugh, who's publicly, noted that he had a cochlear implant and that he was not a candidate for a bilateral, and so he only has one implant. And so I think the evidence was focused on children because they're the ones that are most likely to receive a bilateral.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Maurer, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 491A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. The motion is to move it to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Karen, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 No.
Excuse? Aye. And with that, the bill will move to the floor. Representative Maurer, would you like to carry it?
Yes, I will try.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 491A. This isn't a House sponsor. There's no House sponsor on that bill, is there?
No.
Okay. Next up is we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 676. Sandy, if you will start it off, and Representative Cannon, you're the follow-up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 676 again comes from the Senate with a floor vote of 29 ayes and one excuse, no fiscal or revenue impact on the bill. This prohibits insurers from refusing a claim on the basis that the claim was submitted by a physician assistant rather than a supervising physician. It also repeals the current sunset on the statute ORS 743700, I believe. I think of the ORS, it just says chapter 446.
Great. Thank you, Sandy. Representative Cannon.
I don't have much to add. It's a pretty simple bill. I'm happy to take questions. We didn't hear any testimony in opposition. We did have testimony in support from the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. And if you have any questions, I can certainly try to recall our conversation.
Thank you. It does look fairly straightforward. Any questions for the Access Subcommittee folks? Seeing none, Representative Cannon.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 676 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. The motion is to move Senate Bill 676 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Seeing none, Aaron, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Burrell.
Aye.
Representative
Cannon.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative Dowler.
Aye.
Vice President.
Aye.
Excuse? Aye. And with the unanimous consent there.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 676 be placed on the consent calendar.
Thank you, Representative. The motion is to put on the consent calendar. Any objections? Seeing none, so done. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 676. Go to the bottom of the list then and open a work session on Senate Bill 879A. And I think is this the first work session on this?
This is the first work, Madam Chair, yes. We had a public hearing on the 7th of May on this bill. So we have received public testimony. We'll recall this required the Pain Management Commission to review the pain management component of the curriculum of certain education institution. It eliminates the responsibility of the commission to develop the pain management program for providers. It also was amended to add dentists, occupational therapists, and physical therapists to the list of persons to be considered for membership of the commission, and also added those folks to the list of providers to complete the pain management education program. At that time, the full committee had requested to hear from the physical therapists, the occupational therapists, and the dental groups being added to the bill. So they are here today to speak to the committee on and answer any questions they may have.
Thank you, Sandy. And so the desire of the commission was to remove certain parts of what they were doing and to look at more of the educational curriculum. And do we have folks here on?
We do. We have Kathy Harlan from the commission. We have Patrick Krautz from the general.
How about we start out with the professions being added? So
yes,
Patrick,
Tracy Rutten.
Tracy and
the occupational therapist. Madam Chair, you'll see occupational therapists couldn't be here today, but you do have written testimony on their position on the bill.
From the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board?
Correct.
For the Chaholgate Director?
Correct.
And they are
neutral on the bill.
They are neutral on the bill for the OTs.
Maybe
I'm hopping in.
Are you hopping in for the OTs?
Or ODA, I'm sorry.
Oh, for ODA, okay. Whoever wants to go first, dentists or PTs? You get here.
I'll go first if that's okay, Madam Chair.
That'd be great.
Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, for the record, my name is Patrick Bratson. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry, and I feel like I was deja vu because we were just here yesterday. But anyway,
we're having too much fun.
I know. And actually, I want to tell you, you're a very observant driver in Oregon because I asked you yesterday, and you were obviously going slower than I was going. So no one's going to stop you. So anyway, I just want to be very brief with this testimony. I apologize for not having been at the hearing last week. I originally, when I reviewed the bill, had a little different interpretation until I did some further investigation in the bill. And when I listened to the testimony, I think it was Representative Cannon's voice that I could hear that was asking questions about what were the new professions thinking about this. And so that's why I asked if we could have an opportunity to speak and that you had requested it. We did have a concern about this issue because the current rules that govern the courses are not just a very simple, it's a seven 7-hour process, 7 hours of continuing education would be required one time for all existing dentists and then subsequently for all new dentists. We had a concern over that. We thought it was just the 1-hour web-based program when we originally read the bill. And that, the Board of Dentistry, and I think you'll hear from the ODA, did not have any objection to the 1-hour based program, but the 6 or 7 hours seemed to be a little issue for us. And I just highlighted a couple of issues here. For example, dentistry has the most continuing education required of all the healthcare professions. For those individuals that have anesthesia permits, we even require more continuing education. And so we felt this was probably not going to be in the best interest. I did also hear Chair Greenlee comment, and I know he was joking, when he said, well, I think my dentist definitely needs to go to this. I mean, he's saying what most of us say. When we go to a dentist, we know in most cases there's going to be some pain involved. And that's what they spend a lot of time in dental school dealing with. And so to have these additional 6 hours, we just didn't really see it as a benefit. The 1-hour web-based course is more geared toward after end-of-life care and chronic pain, which obviously we do think, you know, healthcare professionals need to have some knowledge in that area. So subsequent to that, I've had some conversations with the chair of the Pain Commission, and I think they're going to come up and make some statements that we can support the bill, and what they're going to do is, in their administrative rules, make a change so that the dentist will only be required to do the 1-hour web-based program, and so we can be supportive of the bill with that that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Bross. I actually have a comment about that. Is in general, I would agree with the supposition that dentists in general aren't dealing large with chronic pain, but what about folks who deal with TMJ or something like that, where there is, you know, some chronic issues?
And I agree, but the issue is that that's a special and small group of individuals that deal with TMJ, and what this program would be doing is requiring all the dentists to go through these type of six-hour courses. You know, it's no question in my mind that the oral surgeons, for example, in our state have extensive work in pain management, because obviously they're doing the most extensive work that is the most painful. And, for example, Dr. Nichols, who serves on our board, for him to go to an additional six-hour course with all the education experience he already has as an oral surgeon and the fact that he has the highest anesthesia permit allowed by law, I mean, this just wouldn't be a benefit to him. And I think that's what the impetus was to try to get people to understand this and be able to work with those individuals. And I just think that, from my knowledge and working with it, from dentists, I can understand physicians, I can understand even PT and OT. I made the example, my mother 7 years ago died of cancer, and I know what it was like in the end of life having the OTs and the PTs available to help her, and obviously they had to know what things they could or could not do based on her pain levels, and if they didn't have that experience, it would have been excruciating for her. So I guess I can understand that. I'm not sure what the OTs and PTs are going to say, but from a dentistry aspect, to require all the dentists in the state to go through this, I'm not sure we're going to get the benefit out of what it may cost. And I'm really concerned about what this may do to some of the people that are on the margin, the retired dentists who still have a license. We already require them to do 40 hours. This will be included in the 40 hours, but, you know, they only practice maybe a couple days a week. Now they're going to have to take this 6-hour or 7-hour course. They might just say, you know, it's not worth it to keep my license. And plus, as I noted in here, we have a number of dentists, for whatever reason, they maintain an Oregon license, but they're not here in this state. They still have to do the 40 hours of continuing education, but now they'd be required to do this special 6 hours and the 1 hour web-based. This may cause those individuals to drop their license. That's a revenue issue for us. It could be a potential serious revenue issue. So, and I agree with you, though, on the TMJ. That is a chronic pain issue, but I think most of the people that are treating that have had the training that they should. If not, usually we see those complaints come before the board if they haven't had the extensive training.
Okay. Before we move on to the physical therapist, sure. Questions for the dentist? Comment?
Make a comment that
Representative Richardson, yeah.
I was with him until he says we may lose dentists because they wouldn't be willing to take 6 hours of training one time. And if that's enough to push them over the edge, then I think that that's not a very strong argument.
Thank you for that comment. I guess I want to clarify. So dentists currently have to do 40 hours of continuing education every renewal cycle, which my understanding is what, every 2 years?
Every 2 years, correct.
And they could take the 6 hours as part of the 40, right?
They could take the 6 hours, that's correct, but there are not necessarily 6 hours available right now. I mean, these courses will have to be created or found out, and you're talking about approximately 2,800 people that will need to take them in a 24-month period in order to be in compliance with what would be in the law.
And would you, how would you feel about, in terms of the rulemaking process, what if a... again, I go back to the specialty of dentists who are dealing with chronic issues. I guess I'm not ready to make the assumption that they know what, that they've had a lot of this pain management instruction, and maybe they have. I don't know. We could probably clarify that in the rule. That'll be a question for the commission when they come up. But.
And Vice Chair Kotek, for example, in the existing law, the medical board does have an exemption that they can waive certain individuals. It's specific in the law that exists today. The way this bill is written, that exemption doesn't exist, obviously, for the Board of Dentistry to do that. So that might be something to look at. And I agree with you. I mean, if there are individuals that need this, the board definitely would feel very comfortable doing that, but making this all-encompassing. If I can, just to answer Representative Richardson's comment, and I'm not making that in a negative way, but it just is the fact that we do have some people and we have some access issues in the state where we have individuals that do volunteer work. They keep their license. They just work a couple days a week, maybe even a couple days a month. Even doing the 40 hours is a financial issue to them, and so now another 6 hours on top of that. I mean, I get this call all the time. Why should I renew my license? I'm not practicing. And I tell them, that's up to you. I can't make that decision. You know, we like the fact that you have the license. We get a revenue from it, but if you don't want it anymore, that's perfectly your decision. I just know some of them, sometimes that 40 hours is some of the factors of them not doing that. They can very easily, through the Oregon Dental Association, pick up almost all of their credits in one session by going to the Oregon Dental Conference. But again, they'd have to find a program that had 6 hours dealing with pain management, and that might be more difficult for them.
Or if it would be included in the convention, because it's not in addition to the 40, it's part of the 40. And I know with lawyers, when you know, we have our requirements for CLE as well, and what we do is say what's required, and then you fill those notches in, and then you do, you know what number you have to come up with, and so you choose based on what the requirements are. So I don't see quite as burdensome as you're preparing it to be, because it's going to just be part of the 40 hours. If they're going to practice at all, they have to do their 40 hours.
That's correct.
This would just be a portion of it, but you'd rather not have it happen.
Well, from conversations sometimes that I have with the class of dentists that are in that part of their life, just another thing seems to always want to push them over the top, and so I just included that. I could be wrong. They might think it's great. It's just from some conversations I've had with dentists that are sort of in the pinnacle of their career.
And with that, Representative Flores had a comment, but then maybe we should hear from the association if they have a particular position. Representative Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just noticing the definition that is under administrative rule, talking about the pain management education program, defining it in addition to 6 accredited hours of continuing education in pain management, which is understandable in the dental profession, but end-of-life care gives me a little pause.
Let's hope we don't have dentists dealing with that. Mickey, does the ODA have any comment?
Representative Maurer? In our packet today was an email from a Dr. David Karsten, who is an assistant professor, Department of Restorative Dentistry at OHSU. And he says pain management will be a growing concern with our aging population. It is a big problem now, especially since practitioners have variable knowledge. And understanding cooperation of all treating doctors will lead to better served patients. That begins with training. 7 hours is certainly not onerous. So.
And he's a dentist for, he does restorative dentistry, so.
Yes.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kotek, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nikki Terzieff. I'm here today on behalf of Oregon Dental Association. And as Senate Bill 879-A is written and before you today, Oregon Dental Association remains opposed to this bill. We are interested and not opposed to the one-hour online training course, but the additional 6 hours, and I think I'll save the time and energy, but I would echo some of the concerns and sentiments of that Patrick shared with you all, and hope that this committee would consider leaning more towards the one-hour online course.
Any other questions for the dentist? I guess my follow-up would be, the dentist be all right with establishing and rules and carve out for certain types of dentists that perhaps should take? I'm just wondering, are they opposed to the entire thing, or?
Gosh. Vice Chair Kotek, members of the committee, I couldn't answer that question. It seems reasonable to have carve-outs for particular specialties and experts, who are going to be working for chronic pain management, but I wouldn't commit to anything right now on behalf of them without speaking to them.
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you.
How about let's move to the physical therapist then.
Thank you, Chair Greenlight, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. And I'll just state that, you know, for the record, physical therapists are clearly very appreciative and concerned with issues as they relate to pain management for their patients. At this stage, I will say that they're not 100% supportive of the bill or in support of the bill, and they're not 100% opposed to the bill either. I'll just say that over the last, I think month and a half, they've just had a lot of questions regarding how this looks, how it's implemented, how it affects them, and how it affects their patients. In April, the association did email with Ms. Norton with Pain Commission to get some further clarification on what this looks like and how many hours the education would be. They've gotten a lot of those answers since that time. And we've also spoken with the PT board and made sure that they had that communication with the Pain Management Commission as well. And have also reached Pacific University into this conversation since there is that requirement for reviewing the educational component. At this point, I would say that with the 1 hour online, I went ahead and took it. It was interesting. And because I know nothing about any of these issues, but I know that I did notice a lot of it had to do with prescription drugs to manage chronic pain. And I just know that the physical therapists, they're open to this idea, but they'd like the opportunity to work with the Pain Management Commission in the rulemaking process where I understand that the 6 hours of continuing ed exists to make sure that any program is tailored to meet the needs of physical therapists and their patients. I think their biggest concern is they don't want to take a course that's going to be speaking about, you know, maybe prescription drugs when they're not prescribing drugs to begin with. So they just want to make sure that if they're going to do something along these lines, it's a worthwhile program, and they'd like to work with the Pain Management Commission to make sure that that happens.
Thank you. Questions for Tracy?
Not a question.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bruce.
Tracy, did you pass the test?
I don't think it's a pass or fail test. I didn't enter a license number.
And did you do it in 1 hour?
I did, actually. It did, actually. It took less than an hour. But I don't know that I was taking it all in as much as I should have. But, yes.
Well, thank you all. It sounds like it's time to hear from the commission about what they're thinking now, hearing all this. Kathy. Mm-hmm. Hi, Kathy. Good to see you again.
Yeah. I'm Kathy Hahn, Chair of the Pain Commission. Chair Greenlick and committee members. The Pain Commission is very interested in working with these boards and coming up with a solution that is agreeable to all. And if because the actual hours are figured out in the OARs rather than statute, it would be very easy for us to work something out with them according to what the boards are interested in doing. We've not had any board come on board, be involved in this program without their consent and wanting to be a part of this. So we are not interested in shoving something down someone's throat. We want this to be an educational process and something that will help everyone.
Thank you, Captain. Representative Cannon.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Isn't it the case, Catherine, that there are a variety of practitioner types already subject to the requirement to do to get this training?
Chair Greenlook, Representative Cannon, yes. We have probably 8 or 9 different groups already doing this, and I can say that right now we are experiencing something of a renaissance in Oregon with continuing education programs in pain management, and the Pain Commission is quite happy with what's going on. And there are many, many different things going on. There are groups that have programs that have nothing to do with drugs. You know, this is not all about drugs. This is about the pain management of patients being teamwork. And so, yeah, it's been a wonderful thing. But if there are groups that are unhappy, and we actually also with the Board of Medical Examiners, it was up to the board to figure out if all doctors were going to be required to do this or just a few. And they could have exempted pathologists, they could have exempted radiologists, and they decided among themselves that they would make this a requirement for everyone.
Thank you, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hahn, and as I was flippant in referring to the definition that you have that also involves end-of-life care or a combination of continuing pain. But I noticed by your membership, there seem to be a lot of professionals that would not have managing end-of-life questions or within their scope of practice. So can you comment on that?
Chair Green, like Representative Flores, yes. It's actually pain management and or end-of-life. So it's not mandatory end-of-life. It's only if it, you know, it's really quite open. The 6 hours are anything that you feel is representative to you. So for dentists, it would be quite specific. But, you know, I understand their concerns if they think that there's nothing out there right now, 6 hours worth of something that would be pain management that would be good for dentists. That could be a concern.
Thank you. And so do I understand then that you craft the coursework that would pertain in specific areas, or is it a generic?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Flores, we do not craft the programs. We have said that it could be any accredited courses.
Thank you. And so my assumption is if we move this today, since you're on the record saying we'll work this out and rule, that is safe enough for all parties involved and then we can go ahead and consider this. Any other final questions? Thank you very much for being here. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 879A to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Senate Bill 879A has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Aaron, please call the roll.
Aye. Move to be placed on the consent calendar.
There's been a motion to place this on the consent calendar.
You know, I'm
would you like to carry it, Representative Flores?
I would be happy to. And the only reason that sometimes I think it's very nice that we try to expedite the flow, but you know, I have people saying, well, what was this about? Why did, you know, they want just a little bit more information, not necessarily coming out of this committee all the time, but whenever they're. This morning there were a couple of bills saying, when the summary explanation in our little sheet was this long, they were curious as to why in the world we would send something to the floor on the consent calendar that required that much explanation in print.
Well, this could be a good educational opportunity for pain management as well. So Representative Flores, would you like to carry it?
I see that.
Excellent. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the work session on 879A.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair. I'd like to open the work session on Senate Bill 145A, please. We didn't close the public hearing.
Well, you did. Okay. So you're just going to invite.
We're going to invite testimony.
Okay.
It's on the list.
Yeah.
I definitely want to start with Dr. Watt, who has other things and was here last time. And Kathleen, will you join us and start with the board's perspective on this?
There you go.
We did have public testimony for those of you who weren't here from the Oregon Psychiatric Association strongly urging us to add mental health to the substance abuse piece of this, and I find myself kind of astounded that it wasn't already there. Interesting. Thank you both. Can you introduce yourself?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenman, members of the committee. I'm Dr. David Watt. I am chair of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. I am here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 145A. which would add mental health evaluation and monitoring to the existing substance abuse monitoring that takes place in the board's health professional program. It would also codify the name change, the common name usage of the health professional program supervisory council. And it would increase the membership of the supervisory council from 5 members to 7 members. One of these members would be a public member who is not associated with the healthcare field. And lastly, it would require the HPP to report any sexual violation or suspicion of sexual violation of its clients to the Board of Medical Examiners. As you heard yesterday in testimony by Dr. Grass, Oregon is in the distinct minority of states that do not already provide this service for the healthcare licensees. There have been many years spent now with concerned groups in Oregon to establish a platform for such a program. These groups include the Board of Medical Examiners, the Health Professionals Program, the Oregon Medical Association, and the Oregon Psychiatric Association. Many of these meetings have been facilitated by the past dean of Oregon Health Sciences University. In 2006, this collaborative group came up with what is now in front of you as Senate Bill 145. It was introduced with full support, in fact, testimony that it would be supported as written. Also in 2006, the Health Professionals Program underwent an independent audit. The findings of this audit were that the Health Professional Program had a very sound clinical program. There were opportunities for improvement related to the administrative relationship between the BME and the HPP. There were opportunities for improvement relative to the communication and the openness between the two entities. These issues, as well as others from the audit, are being addressed. As recently as last week, members of the Supervisory Council met with members of the Board of Medical Examiners, and we discussed how to approach these issues and to establish an initiative for ongoing work in the area. At that meeting last week, it was confirmed with the two groups that there was support of Senate Bill 145. I might mention that the clinical program of the HPP is a confidential program. It is at arm's length from the Board of Medical Examiners. It is placed in a different location. And there is no involvement of the Board of Medical Examiners in the clinical portion of the Health Professionals Program. The Oregon Board of Medical Examiners, which soon will be known by its new name as the Oregon Medical Board, right, is in full support of Senate Bill 145A, which will add a much-needed and long-awaited mental health component for evaluation and monitoring to the HPP program. This will enhance the protection of citizens of Oregon in that it will allow them protection from healthcare licensees who are at risk of these disorders. It will also help to provide support for Oregonians' access to healthcare. On behalf of the constituents of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners, and that is the citizens of Oregon, I would urge your support for Senate Bill 145A. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if you could answer for me as I'm trying to get my head around the relationship and how this works. Under current law, could someone suffering from a mental disorder rather than an addiction receive treatment under the HPP voluntarily?
The HPP is not a treatment program. It is an evaluation and monitoring program, so that treatment is monitored through that, through that program. The current limitations of the program are for substance abuse, chemical dependency. There are a number of the clients of HPP who have dual diagnoses, and that's quite common, actually. About 60, I believe, of the current clients have a dual diagnosis with mental health and substance abuse. But the program is established and run primarily for monitoring of substance abuse issues currently, not for mental health.
Please. Thank you. Do you have a sense of how many physicians in a year might be missed for these services currently because this isn't available to them?
The audit that we had performed in 2006 suggested that we may be underserving the licensee population currently, even with substance abuse problems. The estimate was between 1,200 and 1,500 licensees are at risk for these disorders. That did not include mental health. I have not heard a good estimate for the numbers of licensees. Perhaps, do you have information on that?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Gelzer, I think we're estimating about 20 a biennium.
Mm-hmm. 20.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have?
I had one other follow-up question. So I had gotten a visit in my office from the Oregon Medical Association, and one of the recommendations was to delay the implementation until July of 2009. What would your position be on that?
I guess to delay the implementation of the amendment. Mm-hmm. I guess to delay the implementation of the -6 amendments.
Okay.
We'll get to the amendment.
So the new program does not go into effect until July.
May I respond? It actually reminds me of a situation I was in a few years ago when I was starting to write my dissertation after 3 years of research. And I asked my major professor, you may be aware of situations like this, I asked my major professor if I could do a little more research because I wasn't sure my research would actually support my conclusions. And his response was, Dave, if you wait till you're 100% certain, if you wait till you find the truth, you'll never publish. Similarly, if we wait to be 100% certain that we won't struggle with the onset of this program, we'll never get started.
Well, we'll hear from them in a moment. I'm not sure that. Actually, my major advisor told me that I probably wasn't going to win my Nobel Prize on the basis of my PhD dissertation, so I could just go ahead and
Did
write
you?
It.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. This, the fiscal for the other funds is assumed in the budget that we passed, I believe. Is that correct?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, that is true.
Okay, thank you.
Exactly. We've got permission to hang in another 10 or 15 minutes after 4 to finish this bill. Have you had a chance to look at the -5 and the -6 amendments?
I've quickly reviewed the -5 is the regarding the hearing open hearings. Is that what this one?
Oh, it isn't an open hearing. It's a show. It's sort of quick show cause hearing. If you,
I see. Yes, I'm sorry. I have had a chance to think about that. With all due respect, Mr. Chair, this looks like a solution looking for a problem. The board has had very carefully crafted due process for its licensees that is monitored carefully by our Assistant Attorney General throughout all of our activities and meetings. We currently have the ability, the licensees have the ability to appeal through the circuit court, as you are aware. This has been done once in the 30-year institutional memory of the board. And was a very efficient process. If As I look at this, it would change that appeal process. It would change the venue of that appeal process. It would not necessarily change the existing due process for the licensees. The end result, when I look at advantages and disadvantages to the board, I suppose an advantage is, if it were changed to an administrative venue, is that that is a recommendation, and that could be overridden by the board. That could be an advantage, I suppose. When I look at the disadvantage, I see a couple of things. The primary one is the cost. We actually did a quick review of our pre-hearing versus post-hearing requirement costs for contested case hearings. And looking at complex cases, pre-hearing requirements, the cases averaged $22,600. Post-hearing, the cases averaged over $44,000.
But if you only have one a year contesting it, I mean one every 30 years.
Well, these were contested case hearings, sir. And currently, although they have not been common, they have in the past been one or two a year. I think we already have six or seven this year.
Of
the contested case hearings.
Something else.
That is something else. But it uses the administrative venue.
But the notion here is it adds something to the circuit court, not substitutes for the circuit court. But it would only be used in the same instance as the circuit court is used. I see. Uh-huh. You only have one every 30 years or so.
That is true. I think the other issue that I see with this is that the process for the demand for an evaluation is part of an investigative process. We have suspicion of a licensee. We cannot do anything for that licensee's to take any action on that licensee's action, again, for due process, until we have evidence. If we do not have evidence, we cannot suspend, we cannot emergency suspend, or have any other action on that license. So the possibility exists that through the appeals process in the administrative venue, there could be an extensive and extended period of time where we would not be able to take any action against a licensee who may represent a risk to the public.
Can you have Claudia Black join us and talk about the -6, please? Have you had a chance to review the -6s?
I have, thank you. And may I comment on that? Or do you want me to?
Let's wait for her to tell us what's on her mind. And clarify whether that July 09 date was on the -6 or on the whole bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm here representing the Oregon Medical Association. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the -6. As Dr. Antoniscus.
You do support the bill, is that right?
We support the bill with the -6 amendments.
But not with them?
Not without them. Right. And Dr. Antoniscus will speak to the reasons for our change in position from the Senate side. And did you just want me to go through the -6s, or did you want to bring him up?
Let's ask him to
come up as well. Okay.
Yeah, I know the her. And the Antoniscus.
Chair Greenock, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Andy Antoniscus, the Dr. A. My name kept coming up yesterday during the committee. People kept talking about Dr. A and B and kept looking up because that's my nickname. Nobody can pronounce my last name. But anyway, I am the I'm an internist in an addiction medicine physician and am the immediate past president of the Oregon Medical Association and have been on the Health Professional Program Supervisory Council for the last 10 years and have actually been the chair of that committee for the last 3 years. And I'm here representing the entire Supervisory Council's five members, two of whom are psychiatrists. And we are placed in an awkward position in that we agree with the ultimate concept up to include mental health. It's the right thing to do. It needs to happen. In our mind, it's really the question of the timing. And per unanimous agreement that the timing of this is inappropriate at this particular time, and that's the reason for the July of 2009 implementation amendment. And let me explain the reasons for that. Recently, there's developed an exceedingly strained relationship between the Board of Medical Examiners and the Health Professionals Program to the point of actually being dysfunctional in our mind, and that it threatens the functioning of the current program as it currently exists to the point of possible mass resignations of supervisory council members and key members of the staff of the Health Professionals Program. An expansion at this time would add increasing significant stress and severely compromise the success of the expansion and eventually the entire program. Let me go through in a little bit more detail, because I think the history is very, very important about how we got where we are today and the current statute.
Clear, but I still am interested in this question that Representative Gelser asked. The Dash 6 does a lot more than simply delay the time. If the only intention is to delay the time, that would require a lot simpler matter than the Dash 6 amendments, right?
The Dash 6 amendments essentially do three things. One is that they ensure the confidentiality of the client, and they say that the council meetings would be exempt from public meeting law, and that follows the model language in the lawyer's assistance program, which exempts both public meeting or exempts both the meetings and the records from public meeting law. And then currently, as you heard, the council and the medical director have the requirement to report relevant information to the BME if a client fails to complete the program, or if they fail to participate in good faith, or if the council believes that the client is engaging or may have engaged in sexual violations. Then the council is required to report all this relevant information to the BME. The second part of the amendment protects the confidentiality of the client regarding information which is not subject to disclosure, so that the A6s prevent the council and the medical director from being examined as to the contents of the report, and that's to protect the information that's confidential that is not relevant to the BME and their investigation. And physicians know that if they fail the program, relevant information will be presented to the board, but that the other information that's not relevant will be held confidential, and that's the reason for that. And then finally, they delay the implementation date to July 1, 2009, with the understanding that there, as Dr. Antoniska said, there's been a lot of dissension and discord between the advisory council and the Board of Medical Examiners. This would give them an opportunity to spend the next 18 months working on that relationship and figuring out if it's going to work. If it doesn't work, it gives them the legislative session to come back with a statutory solution, and then the program would start July 1st of 2009, which would be 18 months after it would start currently, because there's no emergency clause in this bill, so it would first begin January of 2008.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sit on the Human Services Subcommittee for Ways and Means. I don't recall testimony when we were doing the budget for the board that there was concern about this. Did anyone come and testify in terms of the budget hearings around this issue? Because we reviewed adding staff for this very purpose.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, at that time there was support, and there was support that Dr. Antoniska expressed on the Senate side, but at the same time he did express reservations about how the program was going and how the relationship between the two entities was, and talked about a couple of conceptual amendments that would put more of an arm's length distance between the BME, the administrative part of it, and the health professionals program. And so it's been a bumpy ride since then, and they've continued to try to work together but haven't been able to resolve their differences. In fact, as recently as about 2 weeks ago, there was discussion about the health professionals program becoming an entirely separate entity from the Board of Medical Examiners. And a week ago, Monday night, my understanding is members of both of those entities met and decided to go ahead and try to work with the BME to or work together to see if they could get to a solution. But I think Dr. Antoniskis, if he has an opportunity to provide a little bit of history, that would be helpful to the committee.
We don't have time.
Can I do a follow-up?
No. Yes, go ahead.
You know, after the testimony we heard yesterday about the compelling nature of making sure that doctors and the rate of those committing suicide in communities that are represented here, you know, delaying it to 2009 seems... I can understand there might be some issues, but putting it off for 2 years when people could potentially be killing themselves because they don't have access to mental health services, can you respond to that?
Okay, well, I would be more than glad to, because I've been involved in medical staff that actually has had a suicide, and I understand the trauma that goes around that, and have been involved with a number of the committees that worked with trying to get the language for this. And so we wholeheartedly agree with the inclusion, but the problem has been with the statute that was originally developed. There were very significant points that are in the wording of that statute, that the medical director shall administer the program under the control of the supervisory council. The BME will appoint staff to carry out the duties of the council as assigned by the medical director. But what has happened is that there have been marked different variations of interpretation of that statute, to the point that the Board of Medical Examiners has unilaterally assumed the administration of the health professionals program staff.
I'm going to end this discussion because we obviously have an inter-family spat. We're not going to clarify here today. I want to make clear that I understand the situation. I'm going to close this, and we'll reopen a work session on a different day. But if I understand your position, if you're prepared to kill the bill if it doesn't have the dash sixes, and you're prepared to kill the bill if it does have the dash sixes. Is that a clear understanding of the situation?
The amendment dash six, correct.
You're prepared to kill the bill if it has the dash six amendments in it?
Yes.
And you're prepared to kill the bill if it doesn't have the dash six amendments. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, we understand the situation. I'm going to close the work session. We'll reopen it. I do want to open... Hold on. I want to open a work session. I think we can handle very quickly on another bill. We'll come back probably Monday or Tuesday without testimony, and we'll decide on how we cut the baby in half. Thank you all very much. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 8A. It comes to us from the Access Committee. I'm the carrier, I think. There turned out to be no controversy. It's a bill that that requires insurance companies, if they offer one cochlear implant...
Even
simpler than that.
Simpler.
Did that one already. Yes. You already did that one. This is an even simpler one. It's one that requires insurance companies to cover oral chemotherapy if they cover intravenous or parenteral chemotherapy. It's a sort of analogous situation to what happens when they move chemotherapy out of inpatient units to outpatient units, and they turned out not to be covered accidentally, and this is pretty much the same kind of thing. So it actually turns out to be probably much less expensive to do it this way when it works. They're very expensive medications, but they are under any circumstances. Again, there was no opposition. Nobody back there shaking their head no. Is that right?
What do you do when it's a double
name? Is there any opposition back there ready to stand up and jump up and down? No, I don't think so. I'll take a motion on...
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 8. A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And is there any discussion on that recommendation? Would you please call the roll?
Representative
Bonamici. Excuse.
Representative
Grimm.
Aye.
Representative Cannon. Aye. Representative Flores. Excuse. Representative Jones.
Aye.
Senator Jones.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Richardson.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Richardson. Aye. And I'd like to carry it as soon as I make sure I figure out which bill it is we're carrying.
Close
the public hearing at Senate Bill 8A.
And
Representative Cannon.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Maurer to vote on Senate Bill 879A.
Is there any objection to that? No objection. How you vote?
Aye.
How about suspending the rules for me to vote on those other ones?
As long as we've got seven.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we suspend the rules and allow the chair to vote on the bills.
Well, that was
Senate Bill 59A, Senate Bill 491A, and Senate Bill 676.
How do you vote on Senate Bill 59, sir?
Just the acupuncture is repealed.
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Senate Bill 491.
Aye.
Okay. Bill 676.
Aye.
And...
I think I voted on it.
Is that it?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I adjourn the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.